Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode recorded in front of an audience of high school students who just finished studying World War II. Teachers Robert Fauché and Corey Friesen welcomed Philip Starr, a ball turret gunner with the 490th Bomb Group in World War II, to Fresno Christian School. The online student newspaper there, The Feather, which just won all the top national awards again this year, has an article on his visit with photos and quotes from students. I have that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. You'll see photos of the silk escape map Mr. Starr carried during the war. You'll find his Distinguished Flying Cross and a model of a B-17 bomber like the ones he flew in. You're going to hear students ask a few of the questions, too. But right now, we're going to hear about one of his 35 missions in the skies over Europe that easily could have been his last.
The only time I didn't get in the ball turret was one day we got hit with flak, came through the number 5 bulkhead and blew an oxygen bottle up. And when I was standing right in the area, which is not very far, my turret was knocked out because I had a chunk of steel in the column of it. Thank goodness it was in the column of the turret, not me.
And thank goodness you weren't in the turret.
You could manually operate the turret. The turret on landing had to be pointed to the tail, and if you left it down when you landed, it burnt the guns off.
Well, and I've talked to guys who were on crews where they got shot up and they could not return the turret to landing position, and the pilots had to try to land it without killing the guy who's separated from the ground by a little plexiglass down there. Did you ever consider that something like that was a possibility?
After about half a dozen missions, I had a backpack parachute on my back. I figured out how to put a chest chute under my left arm, and I figured if I had to bail out, that I could open the door, fall back out of the plane with my chest and backpack on, and hopefully make it to the ground.
How often would you say in those 35 missions that you guys encountered flak, that fire from the ground?
Every mission.
All 35?
We were on a bombing mission, and we had dropped our bombs wherever it was in Germany. And the navigator made a half a minute mistake or whatever, and it took us down the Ruhr Valley. We flew from one end of the Ruhr Valley to the other, and they figured we had 1,000 guns fire at us as we flew that distance.
1,000 guns.
1,000 guns. And these are 155-millimeter cannon shells.
So this is a picture. That's your airplane?
I was in that ball turret the day that was taken.
And what are those black puffs of smoke around your bomber?
That's flak. That's the guns that's fired at us.
So those are anti-aircraft guns on the ground. Those black puffs are where a shell has exploded right around your plane.
The puff is not as worrisome as the amount of steel that has left the puff.
Right.
Because this shell explodes and blows. Well, the piece of steel I have that was in the ball turret is a little larger than my thumb, about that big, that was in the column. So you have a shell that has blown up, and all these pieces of steel are flying all over the area.
And are you saying you kept that piece of shrapnel? You still have it?
Yes, I do. Being in an air crew means everybody has a job, and everybody better do their job as close to right as can be, because what I did depended on whether those other 9 men lived or not. What they did was the same for me.
I want to take you back to this idea of the flak. Because you said 35 missions, these anti-aircraft guns on the ground are shooting at you every single time. Yet you guys can't change your course. You're flying on target. You have to get over that target, drop your bombs, and move on. And you're here at the bottom of the plane. You're the closest guy to the guns. And there's nothing separating you except a little piece of plexiglass, right?
Yeah.
So what did that feel like, and what did that look like?
Well, you could see the guns going off. You could see the spark on the ground. You just had to pray that you weren't going to be it. In fact, I didn't bring it, but I have a good testament. I mean, you kids know what I'm talking about, the testament.
The military would issue a little pocket New Testament that they would all
put
in. But
the one I had had a steel back on it.
Uh-huh.
So that's a big deal. I had it in my shirt pocket all the time. I got to get hit in a small spot for it to do any good. But it made me feel better.
Yeah, and I want to come back to that thought. But I want you to help these young people who are about the same age as you were, not that far off, to understand what this is like. And I'm sure there were some days where the flak was heavier than others, where maybe you know ahead of time that the next 30 seconds we're going to be flying through something that's going to hit us no matter what?
Well, primarily every day at briefing, I don't know how they knew these things. They would tell us where we were going, what bomb loads we had, how high we would be flying. And they knew when you were flying, if there was a lot of flak, you didn't have to worry about fighters because they didn't want to get knocked down by their own flak. So,
and one of your jobs was to be ready if fighters came at your formation to use that machine gun that you've got there.
They could come up from below, and you could see every once in a while an airplane would go over and you see a, what they call a vapor trail. You look up and you'll see them. The fighters used to like to get into the vapor trail and then come into us from that direction, and we couldn't see them.
Mm-hmm.
I was very fortunate that I was over there later in the war to not have to worry about fighters too much. I'm the one that saw two fighters one day. We were flying between a layer of clouds. Two ME-109s came up from below, went across in front of us. They didn't want us, and we didn't want them, so we were happy. I saw, I'm sure, one of the first German jet fighters, but it was so fast it just went zoom, and that was it. They didn't bother us. One thing that might be interesting to you kids, one day we went to briefing. The officer in charge says, today, if you see any P-38s come up around you, shoot them down. Well, a P-38, that's our airplane. There was no P-38 left in the European theater, but the Germans had captured a squadron of them somehow. So if they came up, we was to shoot them down.
Wow, I've never heard that. That must have been a kind of an eerie feeling just to hear that.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and
ma'am.
We've got a question here. Go ahead.
Was there an estimated amount of planes you shot down?
Thank goodness I didn't shoot any of them down. I didn't have to. The only thing that I had to worry about was flak. Anytime you get flak, you could get an engine knocked out or get the plane shot down. But as far as fighters are concerned, see, my first mission was D-Day plus two. In other words, I flew the 8th. That was another snafu. The weather closed in on us, and we couldn't bomb the first day at all. We couldn't see the ground. In France, we attempted to let the people in France know we were coming and bombing, so they might be able to get into bomb shelters, what have you. So we could not bomb unless we saw what we were bombing.
You told us about the time that you didn't even get in the turret because the flak was so intense. And a piece of that flak ends up hitting the column right by you. How close was that to you, by the way?
Probably within a foot.
Within a foot. He told you how big that piece of shrapnel was, so it could have hurt you real bad or killed you.
That would have killed me, probably. In fact, the radio operator, his station was just up forward from my ball turret. And when this flak hit the oxygen bottle and broke, it broke in two pieces. And we had this map that's laying here is an escape map. We had an escape kit, and it had that map, and it had cigarettes, and it had a razor, had some money. Anyway, the flak came broken too, went into my column, and the other piece hit his escape kit, bounced off the wall and hit him in the head. He thought he was dead, but he didn't even bleed. Thank goodness.
Well, yeah, thank goodness no one was hurt there. But there's also death and destruction surrounding you this whole time.
Definitely.
And I imagine you saw some things from your ball turret that were hard to swallow. I mean, you felt the flak hitting your plane. You saw it hit other planes, I'm sure?
Yeah, my wingman got knocked out one day. He happened to get a 155 that didn't go off yet, and it went through the wheel well. It took the wheel and so on and so forth, probably one engine dead. And the crew, to be able to go back to England, they jettisoned all of their equipment, their guns, their ammunition, everything they could get rid of. and rid of. And four fighters came in on them and shot them up pretty good. But all of the crew was able to get out of this airplane except the pilot and the co-pilot. The co-pilot did get out, but he got hit in the face with a 20-millimeter cannon shell, and he died in the parachute on the way down. The pilot said, well, you guys all get out, and I'll trim the ship up and let it fly on automatic pilot, and I'll bail out. But when he got ready to trim the ship, it was so badly shot up he couldn't trim it. So he flew the airplane back to England.
He made it? Wow.
Only one person was killed. That was the co-pilot.
Did some of the others end up as prisoners?
I don't think any of them got prisoners, but there was one or two of them. They were over France, and they got up and they lived above the PX where they could look into a crack in the window and see the German soldiers coming in to the PX to buy things.
Wow. So they hid out and snuck out through the French underground or something?
The French got them out.
Uh-huh.
And when the crew got back, they brought one bottle of champagne. And I wish they'd have brought some salad because the champagne had turned to vinegar. I have the cork at home. It was bottled in 1936, and we opened it in 1944.
Yeah.
But it wasn't any good. Not that I cared.
So what you were just describing is the bomber that's right next to you in formation.
Yeah.
That could have happened to your plane just as easily, right?
There's a lot of luck goes on with being in an aircraft with a pilot, a co-pilot, a navigator, a bombardier, top turret gunner, engineer, radio operator, waist gunner, ball turret gunner, and another waist gunner, and a tail gunner. So we could have got hit at any time.
Were you prepared for that?
Are you ever prepared for getting hit and maybe get killed? No.
And you said something earlier. You said when you're about to fly through the flak, you know it's going to hit your plane. You know you're going to be hearing it, seeing it, smelling it, feeling it.
One day we went to Paris, outside of Paris, and they told us that the gunners that we wouldn't know about was all French women, I think. I don't know. They were women anyway. And I decided to stand and watch it that day, and I was standing in the waist. And the thing of it is, that airplane has plexiglass on it there, but we didn't have plexiglass. We had open windows. And I was watching down, and I could see the guns going off below me. And I was counting, and I was being a smarty. And all of a sudden, there were three or four holes appeared beside my head, and they decided it's time to go hide someplace. Of course, the skin on an airplane is not much thicker than your fingernails, and there's no armor plating.
So you were standing in that waist gun position, an open air window,
looking down at the guns firing.
And some rounds hit right next to you?
Shrapnel.
Yeah? Like within inches, you're talking?
Yeah. I don't know for sure. I didn't have a measuring stick.
Yeah, and you weren't sticking around to find out. And sorry to belabor this point, but when you...
Oh, I'm not. I'm kidding you.
Well, when you talked about this earlier, what you said was you just had to pray you didn't get hit. Is that something that really happened? Did you find yourself in those moments saying a prayer in the air?
Naturally. If you believed at all, you had to ask somebody to help you.
Mm-hmm.
And he must have helped me because I came home.
And he's celebrating his 93rd birthday this weekend. Break time again. Don't forget to check out the photos, videos, and links at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll get the rest of his story and the impression it left on these students when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.